Let's hear a little bit more from Diane Reeves' Art and Survival CD, Freedom Dance.
Native Americans. Black Native Americans were the first American farmers. There's a popular myth that Europeans learned their farming methods from sub-Saharan African slaves, and that sub-Saharan African slaves were brought to America because Native Americans were supposed to be too lazy to be farmers. Because many Mongoloid Native Americans were nomads, the black Native Americans who lived throughout America did practice agriculture. The first Americans were blacks from Africa. As early as 100,000 BC, Paleo-Americans from Africa had settled in Brazil. The Paleo-Americans were hunter-gatherers. The archaeological evidence makes it clear that Mongoloid Native Americans appear in an archaeological context only 6,000 years before the present. It appears that black Native Americans dominate the states of Washington, Oregon, and California. There were black Native American tribes in Wyoming and the Dakotas. As a result, the Mongoloid Native Americans mainly migrated into the United States southwest, and through the southwest, they infiltrated into Mexico, Mesoamerica, and South America. Much of what is now Georgia was the stronghold of the black Native Americans. These blacks lived predominantly from the Smoky Mountains in North Carolina, southward as far as St. Augustine, Florida. There were also black Native Americans throughout the American Northeast and up into Canada. The vast majority of Native Americans lived in California and along the eastern seaboard in North America. They belonged to many confederations, including the Muskogean and the Algonquin. Some of their tribal names include the Choctaw, Tuscarora, Sekulan, Temecrow, Nanticoke, Cushita, and Yamasee, to name a few. The black Native Americans mainly belonged to the Musqueam and Algonquin confederations. Due to the intimate relationship between the black Native Americans and Mongoloid tribes, the black Native Americans had passed on to the Mongoloid Native Americans, Haplogroup R1, which originated in Africa. The black Native Americans lived on valuable farmlands during the colonial period. The English and Americans wanted this land. This led to violent conflicts between black Native Americans and white Americans. In New England, the black Native Americans were eliminated by slaving, warfare, and forced removal. The French enslaved Native Americans around the Great Lakes, Minnesota, Missouri Country, and Louisiana. The Europeans also needed labor to work the fields. The Americans provided the Native Americans with guns and cheap goods to purchase other Native Americans and made them slaves. Between 1670 and 1720, many black Native Americans were enslaved. The black Native Americans were sold in slavery throughout the 13 colonies, Canada, and the British West Indies. The majority of black Native Americans sold into slavery by whites and Indian slave traders were the Choctaw and Yamasee and other Carolina tribes. Mongoloid Native Americans were usually nomads. The archaeological evidence indicates that the Mongoloid Indians only arrived in the United States 6,000 years ago. Mongoloid Native Americans learned to farm from black Native Americans. Many of these black Native Americans had built the mounds and lived in the mounds. They were usually built along rivers, lakes throughout the United States. The Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Missouri mound sites are located on hilltops overlooking valleys and are clearly defensive works covering many acres with formidable walls of earth, sometimes reinforced by stone, all evidently chosen for their impregnability. In lowland areas where there were probably few inhabitants or unsettled land, the mounds are various geometrical enclosures, octagons, circles, squares, ellipses. These mounds were more than likely built without military intentions. The defensive style mounds found in the United States had lines of embankment, which averaged between 5 to 30 feet high, with enclosures hundreds of acres wide. Leading out from many of these enclosures, there often were parallel walls, many miles long, forming great avenues. Viner felt that these mounds resembled African cities of Luanda in the Congo and the ancient city-states of Benin. W.E. Du Bois noted, the mounds of the mound builders were probably replicas of Negro forts in Africa. That this tendency to build forts and stockades proceeded from the Antilles, whence the Arawaks had come in the beginning of the 16th century, is proved by the presence of similar works in Cuba. These are found in the most abandoned and least explored parts of the island, and there can be little doubt that they were locations of fugitive Negro Indian stockades, precisely such as were in use in Africa. The only occupied mounds seen by Europeans were built by the African slaves, the Arawak Indians, and the black Native Americans in Florida. Hernando de Soto, the only European to see occupied mounds, tells us much about their construction and use. De Soto and his men discussed the mounds they found among the Florida Indians. Here, as mentioned earlier, some African black people. De Soto noted that at Usinta, Florida, the town was of 7 or 8 houses built of timber and covered with palm leaves. The chief's house stood near the beach upon a very high mound made by hand for defense. At the other end of the town was a temple. It is interesting to note that in Florida, one of the major ethnic groups living there was the Yamasee or Jamasee people, which were described as blacks. The mounds in the United States are usually found near rivers. In the Ohio Valley, 10,000 mounds have been discovered. In the north, the mound zone begins in New York and extended along the southern shore of Lake Erie into what is now Michigan, Wisconsin, and on to the states of Iowa and Nebraska. In the southern United States, the mounds lined the Gulf of Mexico from Florida to eastern Texas and extended up through the Carolinas and across the state of Oklahoma. The mounds of ancient America follow the lines of the Mississippi-Ohio River and outlying regions as well. They vary in size from colossal mounds in Illinois to mere blisters rising from the earth. Most, if not all, of these mounds had long been abandoned by their former inhabitants when they were discovered. Many excavated mounds have yielded human bones, weapons, tools, inscriptions, and jewelry. Statues of Africans have also been found in these mounds. As there were two types of African statues found in the ancient mounds excavated in the Western Sahara, Africoid statues of type 1, i.e. humanoids in a sitting position with the hands on the thigh and right knee pointing up, while the other knee is resting on the ground, are found in Tennessee and Indiana at the Angel site. The most common type, style 2, i.e. statues of humanoids in a sitting position with their hands placed across the chest, have also been found in Etowah and Temple Mound sites in Tennessee and Georgia. It is also interesting that anthropomorphic statues found in Polk County, Georgia, are analogous to statues found in Mauritania. One of the major mound sites inhabited in North America was that of the Adena culture in Ohio. The Adena culture existed from 200 BC to AD 400 or 500 AD. Black Africans are characterized as being broad-faced, full-look, illustrating pronasticism, large bone with fleshy noses. Samuel Morton in Crania Americana, written in 1839, note that Adinda people possess ponderous bony structures, large jaws, and broad faces. This description of the Adena fits exactly the description of the West African type. The Adena, or Hope Wheel culture, as we call it today, was a dominant force in the United States during this period. They have left numerous copper bracelets, rings, stone tablets, and effigy pipes made in the form of Africans. At the Great Spirit Mound in Adams County, Ohio, a gold breastplate has also been found. Professor F.W. Putnam also mentioned the discovery of an Egyptian-looking figure in these mounds. Most archaeologists believe that agriculture began in the United States among the mound builders. The Adena Indians began agriculture in the United States. Using tools made from animal bone, tortoise shell, and stone, the Adena people grew many crops, including maize, squash, pumpkins, gourds, squash, and sunflowers. Corn, beans, and squash are three main agricultural crops of the Black Native Americans. They were considered inseparable by the Black Native Americans, and thus they were given the name Three Sisters. The Adena mound builders used their mounds for habitation. They also buried their dead in the mounds. By 100 BC, another group of mound builders replaced the Adena people. This new population was the Hopewell people. The Hopewell people grew many crops, including corn and squash. The Black Native Americans used two principal farming methods, rotational farming and the three-sister farming method. The rotational farming method required the Black Native Americans to plant a crop for 3 to 5 years. After this period of time, they would clear new land and plant a new crop. The Black Native Americans rotated the farmland because they felt the soil would be ruined due to the overuse of the land. Black Native Americans used the three-sister farming method. The three sisters are the three principal crops cultivated by the Black Native Americans: corn, tapari or common beans, and squash. These three crops thrive together. The three-sister method was beneficial to all three crops. First, the farmers would make a mound and plant the corn.
So this, we're listening to a presentation by a scholar. His name is Clyde Winters, and he is a scholar and author. He's the author of African Empires in Ancient America. We are not just Africans, the Black Native American. Archaeological Decipherment of Ancient Writing Systems, Afrocentrism, the Myth or Science, the Ancient Black Civilizations of Asia, Olmec Language and Literature, Ancient African History Primer, the Dravidian Connections, the Extra-Indian Linguistic Connection. Dravidian or Tamil is the language of the Indus Valley Writing, a study of the most ancient Tamil language, Herodic Writing and Literature, the Paleogeography of Afro-Americans and Africans, Before Egypt, the Ma Confederation, Africa's First Civilization, the Kushite Prince Akhenaten and the Roman Kushite War. And so that represents a good piece of literature written. Here's one more: History of Blacks in America from Prehistory to 1877 and the Kushite Prince Akhenaten and the Roman Kushite War. I guess that's part two. So he's a very esteemed author. Dr. Clyde Winters, and we were listening to one of his video discussions on the role of Black Native Americans in introducing agriculture into the United States, and the vast majority of Native Black Americans lived in California, the southeastern United States, and along the eastern seaboard in North America. So this is, according to his research, and it says, They belonged to many confederations, including the Musqueam and Algonquin. Some of their tribal names included Choctaw, Tuscarora, Sikolon, Tamakra, Nanticoke, Cachita or Cachi, the Yamasee are some of the names. The BNA tribes mainly belong to Muskogean and Algonquin confederations due to the intimate relationships between the BNA tribes and the Mongolian tribes. The BNA, given the high frequency of haplogroup R1 in Africa, introduced this haplogroup to Native Americans, not Europeans. This view is supported by the high frequency of RM173 among Africans and Native Americans in North America. One of the interesting things about Dr. Clyde Winters, is that he is a linguist, and he studies ancient languages as well as ancient DNA haplogroups, and follows his theories through studying the divergence of language and through the movement of DNA through haplogroups. So to me, that's a fascinating way of looking at this material. So the number to call is 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. And we are looking at the Original People Part 2 USB flash drive, for Heart of Mind flash drive. We're also offering you, at this time, you can pledge for a package called The First Americans Were Africans. It's a dollar a day pack. It includes the flash drive that I've been speaking to you about. And it also includes several other material. The First Americans Were African book by Dr. David Imhotep. It includes We Were Here Before Columbus pack and the Harry Hubbard DVD pack. So it's a massive package, and you can have an opportunity to participate at the $365 level, and you'll receive all this massive amount of material. So I wanted to play that Clyde Winters to give you some context of the material that you're going to find in the flash drive. I'm going to play some of this other material from the pack as well. Okay, also in this Aboriginal American Literature pack, we read that Volume 6 of this pack, let's go back to where we left off. We left Volume 5, The Lenape and Their Legends. Volume 4, The Migration Legend of the Cree Indians. Volume 2, The Iroquois Book of Rights. And Volume 1 is an overview Volume 1 is the Maya Chronicles. Okay, so we're going back now the other way and to see what we left out there. So we have also, after the Lenape and their legends, the Annals of the Kakikels. And so this is the original text with a translation, notes, and introduction. So this is actual texts that were translated, both for its historical and linguistic merits. The document which is presented in this volume is one of the most important in Aboriginal American literature, written by a native who had grown to adult years before the whites penetrated into his ancestral home, himself a member of the ruling family of one of the most civilized nations of the continent, and intimately acquainted with its traditions. His work displays the language in its pure original form and also preserves the tribal history and a part of the mythology as they were current before they were in the least affected by European influences. So this is Volume 6. So it's a literal translation. of these Annals of the Kakikels. And volume 7 is Ancient Nahuatl Poetry. And it's containing the Nahuatl texts of ancient Mexican poems with translations, introductory notes, and vocabulary. Volume 8 is Rig Veda Americanas. And these are sacred songs of the ancient Mexicans in this volume 8. Also, we go on to Aboriginal books. We have Aboriginal sites in Kentucky, Ohio, Mississippi. Another Aboriginal spirituality, Aboriginal philosophy paper is included among these works. And we have also the history of the United States from Aboriginal times to Taft's administration. This is another book by John Redpath, and it has within it many multiple volumes. So all these volumes are included in your flash drive. Volume 1 is this overview. And then it goes on through, it looks like three volumes of this whole history of the United States from Aboriginal times to Taft's administration. So included in that would be the Red Man, the Indian's Mode of Life, Nations and Tribes, Appearance and Characteristics. And it has here Icelanders and Norwegians in America, Spanish Discoveries in America, the French in America, English discoveries and settlements, voyages and settlements of the Dutch, Massachusetts, the New England Confederation, the Charter Oak, the Massachusetts, the Colonial Wars, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, New York. So it goes into all the different conflicts of what happened in this country from original times, Aboriginal times. So that's very powerful in this overall volume, which we are offering you. Original People Part 2, USB. It's a $150 pledge of support. And in this flash drive, you will be receiving multiple dozens of full, complete texts that give us a history, the real history that we've not learned through our education system. So there's American Slavery and Finances. This is another book. The Counselor at Law in the Supreme Court of the United States. Senator of the United States, Secretary of the Treasury, Commissioner to China. This is the author. So the volume contains various pamphlets published during the last 6 months. This was published in 1864. The subject discussed relates to the present rebellion in America and embraces Jefferson Davis and repudiation, recognition, slavery, finances, and resources of the United States. So it's connecting all these social systems to how the United States built its wealth. Also, we have The Life and Voyages of Americus Vespucius. Okay, so this is the person who lays claim to the name of America, but we have reason to believe that he is certainly not the discoverer or the charterer of America. Anyway, we have Ancient America Pictorial of Ancient America was published in 1927, and this actually gives you some of the early photographs of ancient ruins. Another book, Ancient Cities of America, Journal of the American Geographical Society in 1888, and this is about the civilization, the indigenous civilizations, and how they were influenced by world contact. We have another book, the Ark of the Covenant, ever-blessed Mother of God. So this is a series of short discourses on the joys, sorrows, glories, and virtues of the ever-blessed Mother of God. So it's more of a feminine consciousness. We have a book called Mapping the Aztec Capital. In 1524, the Nuremberg map of Tenochtitlan, its sources and meanings. So this was, we have to understand when the colonizers came into Aboriginal territories, they recognized that they were dealing with advanced people. So the first step was to take the information, the knowledge. The next step was to take the resources, the land. And in those processes, the Aboriginal people became either indoctrinated, mind-controlled, enslaved to support the economic system, or just genocided and removed from the physical planet. So this is the consequence of this first letter that I started with, and that first letter was the letter from King Leopold to his clerics in the Congo, explaining how they were going to proceed to re-indoctrinate the Aboriginal indigenous people of those lands. Also, we have The Kabatian Discovery by John Boyd Thatcher, written in 1897. And this explains what discovery really means. It's the whole dialogue. It's 36 pages of a presentation from the Transactions of the Royal Society of Canada, second series, 1897 to 98, volume 3, English history, literature, archaeology, etc. A people may acquire territory by discovery. So if you hear that, a people may acquire territory by discovery, by conquest, and by purchase. So the meaning of discovery is not to come upon something you didn't know existed. The meaning of discovery is to lay claim, may acquire territory by conquest or by purchase. The title by discovery is said to be original. Title by conquest or by purchase is said to be derivative. So the original discovery would be the original indigenous people who have acquired the territory prior to colonization. But the title by conquest or by purchase is said to be derivative. In the law of nations, the title of discovery confers sovereignty. So understand what this means. This means that when Columbus and his cohorts came and planted their flags on the American soil, which had previously been inhabited by Aboriginal indigenous people, that by claiming that claim of discovery is not just to claim the land in symbolism, it is taking from the Aboriginal people the land and is taking from the Aboriginal people the sovereignty, so that the discoverer or explorer or colonizer is laying claim to the sovereignty which had previously been that of the Aboriginal indigenous people. So these new colonizers are coming with the claim that we are now the sovereigns of this land, and you are now, therefore, the original people become the enslaved, the resource from which the new sovereign, the colonizing sovereign, will grow. So the land, the resources of the land, the people, the energy of the people you know, folded into slavery. And you could even look at this in terms of the architecture of our modern society, especially in places like Philadelphia, D.C., and New York, being built along the indigenous structures and mound building and various stone sculptures that were here in the Americas were devastated. And on top of that, power vortex is where many of the state capitals have been built. So it's a real tapping into the energetic force of these original territories and original people to fuel what we now have as our parasitic society. So that's how I understand the Kapatian discovery. And it's a, you know, it's a full volume. It has 36 pages, but it really goes into understanding the mindset and the rule of law generated through these European dynasties, along with the mostly fueled by the Vatican, which is the continuation of the Roman Empire, essentially. But essentially what was happening is through these rule of law created through this power base, Aboriginal peoples across the world were exploited in this way. Their lands were exploited, and that's what discovery actually means. Discovery does not mean you found new land. Discovery means that you have claimed through conquest or purchase those resources. Anyway, another book we have here is Capitalism and Slavery. The present study is an attempt to place in historical perspective the relationship between early capitalism, as exemplified by Great Britain, and the Negro slave trade, Negro slavery, and the general colonial trade of the 17th and 18th centuries. Every age rewrites history, but particularly ours, which has been forced by event to reevaluate our conception of history and economic political development. So this is a book actually written in 1944 by Eric Williams, University of North Carolina Press, Capitalism and Slavery, making those very clear connections. And we have that volume on our collection on this flash drive. Chinese slavery in America. Did you ever think that perhaps the Chinese were enslaved in America? Well, apparently, well, to some degree, it still is a factor if you look at it from the perspective of sexual slavery. Okay, we have a book here. We have some material by John Henrik Clark, Christopher Columbus and the African Holocaust, Slavery and the Rise of European Capitalism. Christopher Columbus, how he received and imparted the spirit of discovery. Christopher Columbus, synopsis of the work, published in 1904, his life, his work, his remains. The Colonial History of Vincennes under the French, British, and American governments. From its first settlement down to the territorial administration of General William Henry Harrison, being an address delivered by Judge Law. So this is the historical, it's a colonial history of the French, British, American governments. Then we have from the 19th U.S. Congress in 1827, Colonization, Free People of Color. So this was actually gone through Congress, how they were going to colonize free people of color. And this was to move them from the East Coast to the mid-states and West Coast, and to move people from the United States into the African continent. So colonization was taking American free people of color, displacing them into other regions in order to make room for the colonized states to lay claim to their discovery. Okay, we have another 1882, Colored Race and Human Slavery, The Origin and Progress. So this gives us that, how this progressed. And then we have another book, Colored Washington After a Generation of Freedom, published in 1901. And this is the historical, biographical, and statistical study of colored Washington. So we're talking about the District of Columbia, which was not a state, and still really not a state. But the people there, while remained in many ways enslaved long after slavery was ended. Constitutional and Educational Solution of the Negro Problem. And this is an address, again, delivered in the Senate chamber in Albany, New York. So what these are is this is a series of documents in which they are justifying through the congressional record how to eliminate the cultural influence and of Aboriginal people, to displace the Aboriginal people. We have three volumes, Dawn of Modern Geography, Volume 1, Volume 2, and Volume 3. What's interesting about Volume 1 is it goes into the conversion of the Roman Empire. So it goes back to the Roman Empire to 900 AD. And basically what's interesting about Modern Geography Volume 1 is that it goes into explaining how the Christian era was inculcated. So it talks about how this geography was set up by a series of Roman kings, such as it is, you know, Caesars, who claimed certain areas to say, well, this is where the Christ was born. This is where the Passion took place. This is where Muhammad was born. This is where different alliances occurred. So they kind of, it shows how modern geography was created according to the inculcation of Christianity in a population that had previously been other forms of multiplicity, many forms of Hebrewism or Mohammedism or Jewism, Jewishness, various kinds of Egyptian, African belief systems. So there was a systematic transition, and it happened through various stages, through various leaders, through various periods of time. So it talks about the primitive pilgrims of Latin Christendom down to Justinian, and that's AD 300 to 350. And then it goes down to talk about the pilgrims in detail from Justinian to Muhammad. And then it talks about the pilgrims in detail during the later centuries of period, circa AD 680 to 870, 900, and then commercial AD 300 to 900. So it may seem complicated, but what this is actually doing is showing us how we went from this ancient historical record with a spectrum of historical Aboriginal indigenous beliefs. However, we might look at that as being conflicted or harmonious. There was a multiplicity of that happening. So this Dawn of Modern Geography shows how the Vatican, through the Roman Catholic Church, Christianity, actually apportioned geography to land and then redrew the boundaries between various regions to identify these regions according to the country that they were being named as. So Sudan, you know, came out of, you know, another land. The Sudan might have come out of the Coptics, or the Sudan might have come out of the Egyptian, or the Sudan might have come out of the Kemetan. So rather than saying this is a Kemetic people, these are Egyptian people, these are Hebrew people, they became bound to the land based on what happened in this period. So before that, it wasn't so much the case. Modern Geography Volume 2, which is really fascinating to me because it really looks into the more modern colonization process. So it's really about this geography series is about how the world was restructured, how boundaries came about, how people were isolated by borders, by language, by colonial structures as a point of control. And this is what the Modern Geography Volume 2 looks at. It looks at how the Middle Ages and how, you know, the perhaps the Moors or the more coherent colonizing factor that's coming up out of Kemet, Egypt, is coming north into Spain, into southern Europe. And then we have the northern Europeans coming back down to, to push the Moors back into the regions of the African continent. So this whole middle period where nobody really knew for sure where it was going to go, where the Romans going to be on top, where the Moorish Mohammedans going to be on top, where the Hebrews were going. So it was this competing energies and how it influenced geography. So I find that fascinating, to be absolutely fascinating. And, you know, Volume 3, I guess, takes us to the whole end game, you know, how we ended up where we are right now. Okay, so we have something called Deconstructing the Map, the Rules of Cartography, Deconstruction, and the Cartographic Texts, Maps and the Exercise of Power. So what this does is it begins to show us how the geography restructured the land and how the maps became an instrument of power. The maps became an instrument of power because they were changed. So if you look at the more ancient maps that go past the Islamic historical record, the maps were the reverse. So everything we see at the south would have been at the top. Everything we see at the top would have been at the bottom. And that's how the map was visible. But the also part of deconstructing the map and making it instrument of power is that when it moved through all these various stages to the Mercator projection, it shows a stunted size for the continent of Africa, stunted size for the continents of South America, and it greatly expands the distortions to expansion, the smaller northern regions. So it gives a psychological powerful expression to the people who are then mind controlled through that map. Anyway, so we're coming close to the end of this particular time period, and I'm talking because we are indeed going through these, you know, the contents of this material. Original People, Part 2, USB, Heart of Mind Radio, which is giving you a large spectrum of of the history, to be able to reconstruct our history and come to the full understanding of the wisdom, the ancient wisdom that was intended for us to receive from our ancestors. The number to call is 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. I'm going to play a little bit more music underneath me because it's, well, I have to encourage you to make that pledge right now. Otherwise, we are going to fall off the edge of the earth. No, not really. But we are at a point of very real crisis opportunity that you can make a difference with your pledge of support. 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. 602-320-3602. I'm playing a little prayer for compassion, heaven here on earth. David Darling. Because it represents, it's representative to me of what is needed. Compassion. We need to bring our compassion back to the earth. And this is not accomplished by pitting one extreme against the other of one, you know, left-wing, right-wing violence into an endless cycle of chaos and destruction. It's in time for us to all sit back and say, what has been the path to reach us into this state, our world into this state? So when we look at all these systems that are in control, the banking system, you know, the so-called government legislative systems, the taxation systems, all the aggressiveness of corporations and excess towards war, towards depleting our environment, everything towards the accumulation of wealth at the expense of humanity. How did we get into this world state? Well, this history is what we're speaking of. We're looking at where it comes from, how it was generated, and how it's perpetuated. So when we see in our world indigenous people being abused with fire cannons and all kinds of aggressive, violent opposition to their simple protest and desire to preserve and protect water, to protect land, when we see young black people, young black children, young black men, young black women being confused within themselves, but also being executed on the streets. This comes from something. It comes from a mindset, a mentality, a state of ignorance that has penetrated deep within the collective unconscious, the cellular structure. It underlies all of the fear that gets triggered by the nonsensical imagery we get on the screens, by the nonsensical hate-filled propaganda we get through our ears, through the TV, through the radio, through whatever. We have this stuff regurgitating through ourselves, our field. And it's all based on this understanding of history, this separation from the indigenous way, the holistic understanding of comprehending the vast spectrum of reality into this narrow, isolated, compartmentalized state of existence in which we can pursue money and pursue success and pursue patriotism in these little isolated boxes of reality without taking into account the magnitude of the historical record that has brought us to this point. And why is it important? Because this is the mechanisms by which we are mind controlled, by which our society is controlled, by which the horrors of the world continue to take place. If you ignore the fact that Aboriginal people were genocided on this planet, on this plane, across the plane in various continents, the genocide of the Aboriginal people, the wisdom holders, the wisdom keepers. Then there was an infusion, a crossbreeding, and we open up into this new generation, which is more akin to who we are, I believe, which are parts of us. We have this genetic DNA wisdom coming through us through that ancestral line, but we also have the confusion of mind programming, of mind games, of control and manipulation. So we need to grab hold of that Aboriginal wisdom and begin to cultivate that so that it can blossom in our consciousness. But at the same time, we need to unravel all of the damage that was done through discovery and colonization and exploitation and we can find a path that will allow us to be whole without being buying into the system of exploitation. And we're asking you to call. That number is 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602 for the Original People Part 2 USB flash drive. Original People Part 2 flash drive can be yours for that pledge of $150. A $150 pledge will give you no less than, and this is really only a good half of what we are in this document, in the flash drive, and it's a 30-page or more page document of just the table of contents. And we have Prehistoric America in 5 volumes, which talks about the mound builders, their works and relics. It talks about the mysterious races, the mound builders and their works, the mound builders and the mastodon, the mound builders and the buffalo, burial mounds of the different districts, the sacred enclosures of Ohio, the stone grail people, the migration of the mound builders, village life and the mound builder cults, pyramidal mounds in the Gulf states, defensive works of the mound builders, the religious works of the mound builders, water cult and the solar cult, mound builders and Indian relics, symbolism among the mound builders, relics from altar mounds and ash pits, relics showing the civilization of the mound builders. So what is this saying? What is this saying to you, that there is a whole history and a whole study of the prehistoric Americans that was recognized and classified and written about and then stored away in antiquity so that those of us who are born in this time on our planet don't have the information that came before the civilizations that were wiped off of this continent? They are still present. The historical record is here, and this is what we're offering you in this flash drive. It's just a magnificent, magnificent opportunity to explore the truth and to be able to use this information in your own way. The reference is here. Maybe you want to write a book. Maybe you're working on a book and you need the research. Maybe you're a teacher, or maybe you're a homeschooler. You're working with children who in a revolutionary way. Maybe you want to deprogram your own mind and come to understand, to connect back to that straight path from how I would perceive it, the celestial, the divine, through into the human, through into the distortions, through into the current state of chaos we live in, and so that we can chart our way back into a created reality that is compassionate, that is able to preserve life and liberty and freedom and happiness, not as it currently looks at the expense of other beings, but truthfully done in such a way that we all become part, we all benefit. In addition, at the $365 level, at that $365 level, we are offering you this really big package. The first Americans were Africans. It's $1 a day pack. And you receive the book by David Imhotep, PhD, The First Americans Were Africans. You also receive the Original People Part 2 flash drive. So everything we've been speaking of, you receive when you call that number, 516-620-3602. And we also offer you the packs. We were here before Columbus pack. And that's an amazing package that offers a whole series of premiums that are going to, that you're really going to benefit from, including The Came Before Columbus by Ivan Van Sertima. So that's an amazing part of that package. So we want you to call now, 516-620-3602. You also receive in this package the Harry Hubbard DVD pack. So that's a series of 5 DVDs that takes you deeply into an inquiry about the historical record. And this is a premium produced by In Other News with Jeff Brady. And that's it's an amazing offer as well. So you will get all of this with your package of the first Americans were African dollar a day pack. That's $365 that you will be making that pledge to support WBAI. And the choice I'm asking you to make today is at the $150 level, the original People Part 2 USB flash drive. It's a $150 pledge. And you can also receive this, the first Americans or African dollar a day pack, for that $365 pledge. When you call that number, 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. We're down to the last few minutes. Get those calls coming in right now. Hit the ground running. And this is Dreaming Wide Awake, the CD. Liz Wright. So let's get those calls coming in. The number is 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602. This flash drive, Original People Part 2, is very dear to my heart. I've been doing this research for quite a long while, and I've been building it over the last several years. And it is an incredible resource historically, but also to awaken, to blow the mind open so that we can understand the context of this world and understand how this happens so it can be unraveled, so that we can unravel it in our individual personal lives. And that's where we have so much power to make a difference for ourselves and also for our collective reality, human reality. 516-620-3602 is the number to call. 516-620-3602 is your number to call. And we are asking you to show your support for WBAI Radio and for Heart of Mind by making that call. 516-620-3602 is your number to call. The day has just begun. Hit the ground, baby. Hit the ground.
This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go. Saturday, November 4, it begins. 2 p.m. at 42nd Street and Broadway. Together, we will march in unity with conviction and courage, overcoming fear and uncertainty, to put a stop to the grave danger that the Trump-Pence regime poses to the world. Only the people acting together can end this nightmare. The future depends on it. Saturday, November 4, 2 p.m., Times Square. RefuseFascism.org.
This is Andrea Katz of WBAI.
And Jim Wintner, curator of the upcoming WBAI art auction.
Jim and I are excited to announce the launching of the online auction site and hope you will also join us for the live benefit exhibit that will take place on Thursday, November 16th at the Chesterfield Gallery in Lower Manhattan.
Online bidding begins Thursday, November 2nd. Go to WBAI.org and click on the art auction pop-up.
Both well-known and soon-to-be-well-known artists have donated a wide range of artworks for every taste and budget.
This is an opportunity to acquire artwork by such luminaries as Tom Otterness,
whose little bronze men adorn the subway at 14th Street,
Richard Avedon, Allen Ginsberg.
Did you know he was a photographer too?
Barbara Mensch and Richard Haas.
So go online to WBAI.org and mark your calendars for the live auction exhibit reception on November 16th.
We did it before and we can do it again.
The owners of the Empire State Building where WBAI's transmitter is located have pushed WBAI into a crisis. The crisis is real, and we need your help to turn this crisis around. We need your time, energy, and especially your skills. We need you to volunteer to help build our off-air fundraising campaign. We need grant writers, event planners, social media and computer technology experts, phone banking volunteers, and particularly those experienced with obtaining large donor contributions. Are you an experienced fundraiser? We need you now. Historically, WBAI listeners have shown great heart and courage in the face of political adversity. We must do this again to save our station. Please call 347-647-WBAI or 347-335-0008 or email us at wbai.pacifica@gmail.com and let us know how you could help. Again, please call us at 347-647-WBAI or 347-335-0008 or email us at wbai.pacifica@gmail.com. Together, we will win.
We did it before and we...
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us, writer, editor, pundit, and curator, Matthew Kressel. We're going to be talking about a movie. You better stay tuned. Oh, yes, it's all spoilers. I didn't mean that to anybody. Hello, we're on the air. I've been talking to people on Facebook Live, you see, where there is at the moment, a relatively small audience. Is this? Yeah, the mic is barely on. I'm tapping it. Do me a favor, Matt. Tap your... Oh, first
tap,
of all...
Tap, tap, tap.
Try that again.
Tap, 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 tap.
Okay.
There we go.
Bring that mic a lot closer.
A lot closer. All right.
Yeah. Aim it sort of like, yes.
Like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How's that?
Among other things, say how's that again.
How's that again?
Thank you. Yeah. The headphones.
Headphones are helpful.
Mine weren't turned on. You don't really need yours unless we take phone calls.
All right.
Okay, we have to get announcements out of the way. We will tell people first that this is a show about the Blade Runners.
The Blade Runners, the brothers.
Yes, there are several. Yes, yes, there are several involved. There are several just in one movie. But they are all... Well, no, Paul isn't present. He gets killed in the beginning of the first, or at least hospitalized. Paul, isn't it?
You're talking about David Bautista?
No. I mean, in the first movie, the first Blade Runner who's giving the test and
Holden,
gets blown away by Brian James.
Yeah, Holden was shot right at the very beginning.
Yes, Holden.
Holden.
Oh,
yeah.
Here's a trivia. Before I have a great trivia question.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. In one scene in the original Blade Runner, you have Roy Batty.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the name of the replicant who shoots Holden right in the beginning? The actor's Brian James.
Leon.
Leon, absolutely.
Okay.
So what similarity do they have in another science fiction world by an auteur? I figured this is it hit me the last time.
When you say what relation, can you give me another hint?
Yeah. Another director of major science fiction movies have used both actors.
Well, Outland, right? Wasn't the... No?
No. Good movie, though.
I'm not sure.
The answer is... That Brian James is Bruce Willis's boss and the head of the police in The Fifth Element.
Oh, right, right, right.
And in Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, Rutger Hauer is the president of Earth, both movies directed by Luc Besson.
Okay. Well, that's sort of like a couple degrees of separation there, though.
Well, it's one director's degree of separation only.
All right.
And both directors are certainly auteurs with French accents.
I give you credit for linking the two. I wouldn't have connected them quite like that, but
I don't know why it came to me while I was watching. But anyhow, folks, we are going to be discussing Blade Runners, Blade Runner the original, because you have to go to that source. We're not going to be discussing Philip K. Dick for the most part, because that's really a totally different universe. I was going to tell you, we were in a pub before. The thing that really blows me away in the book that never happens in the movie at all and couldn't happen in the movies, that Rachel is made out of the exact same model and looks identical to Pris.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Rachel thinks that he can't retire Pris because they look the same.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that there's a limited number of models, that's something I was actually wondering watching Blade Runner 2049. And, you know, like, well, how many different implants could there be? But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
We are.
What we need to tell listeners is that, the talk is going to be that kind of deep-level geek talk about Blade Runner. And I can't think of anybody better to discuss this than Matthew Kressel. Because is it fair to say that the original Blade Runner is one of your favorite movies of all time?
No, that would be incorrect. I would say that it is my favorite movie of all time.
Okay.
I was
thinking of saying that, but...
It is. I've seen the original film in the various versions. As we were saying before, I've lost count.
Yeah.
Over 100 times, I would guess.
Wow!
I used to be
I'm
able
only
to
about recite, 7 or 8.
I used to be able to... Well, I probably still could recite the film from start to finish from memory. I used to do this party trick on New Year's Eve that we would put on one of the versions of Blade Runner. My friends would pick a random scene, mute the TV, put on the closed captions.
And you would MST3K it.
No, I would
you do the real
turn
dialogue.
My back to the screen, and I would just get like a cue so I knew where we were, and then I would recite the lines. And usually within like, you know, I would get about 98% of the lines. This is not something that I'm necessarily proud of.
Right. This is as I tell people when I say I've worked here for more than 50 years, I say this is not a boast. Yeah. This is a call for help.
It was kind of an obsession of mine for years to just watch the movie as often as possible.
One of our listeners says, good science fiction is hard to do, and I'm going to have to pick up the phone, and financial risk great. So I appreciate when science fiction movies are made. Blade Runner was fascinating, typo, just checking out the background. It's like what the world would look like if we were all crowded into a Hong Kong-type living space. I would say that was true of the first film.
The first one
is
more Hong Kong. The second one, I got elements of, like, you know, northern Russia and, like, parts
Siberia.
Of... Siberia. Like, you know, parts of... Honestly, like, when Kay was flying over the city, it reminded me of Queens. Like, just how densely packed... Or, you know, Queens and Brooklyn, how densely packed the buildings are together, and you just see this little space between them, especially if you've ever taken the M line, which is just above the height of the building.
Well, I lived on the 7 train.
Oh, the 7 train, you know, any of the elevated trains.
Because until 25 years ago, I lived all my life in Jackson Heights.
Yeah.
So I'm a Queens kid. Or as I tell people, well, I grew up in Queens, but now I'm in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
So, but Queens is a stomping ground for me. I've also lived in Forest Hills and various haunts.
Mm-hmm.
Of Queens, but Queens is very much I'll tell you this about Queens. It has a better concentration of restaurants.
Depends on where you are in Queens.
Well, there's some better restaurants in Brooklyn. Yeah. But, you know, it's like if you go to a particular neighborhood, like where I grew up in Jackson Heights,
right,
in Elmhurst, you can't go five blocks without a really great restaurant being nearby. And you can just name